You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. The Philosophical Roots of Chinese Thought by Scott MacDonald.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Scott MacDonald. Spoiler, this is not a lecture about objectivism. But it is a lecture about understanding philosophy and ideas and applying those to the real world and understanding how people act based upon the philosophy that they hold. And it's on a topic that matters to a lot of us day in, day out. I just spent 3 years in Washington at the Pentagon going around to think tanks, and I saw people getting China wrong quite often. And, you know, I often ask myself, why? What are they missing here? And it increasingly came back to not understanding the fundamental ideas that were driving Chinese decision makers. And this brief is kind of an outgrowth of that. But before I go into that, I am a serving officer in the United States Marine Corps, and it is important you understand that any opinions I give today are mine, do not represent those of the government, the center I work at, or the Department of Defense. That being said, let's jump into why people don't understand China. And it comes down to how they see the world. These are the three traditional IR schools of thought, international relations schools of thought, and it's the way that most international relations theorists are examining things. The first one, realism, you know, simple, we've all played Risk, it's powers and their capabilities striving to gain advantage in a world defined by Hobbesian anarchy. Liberalism, generally, you start to get some ideas in there. Right, we're talking about what type of economic and government, but in the modern incarnation, it's very much about institutions. I couldn't bring myself to put a UN flag on there, but the idea is that just by joining the UN, states will be normalized in their actions, and they'll start acting a certain way, and that'll be good, and peace will break out all over. You know, Wikipedia, the idea is we all join in this, and as we interact with Wikipedia, it shapes how we act in that community. A similar idea writ large with states in the international community. Now, constructivism, when I started studying IR theory, along with my buddy, the Tyrannosaurus Rex, I said, this is ideas. I can get into this, right? But the more I looked at it, it wasn't about ideas and understanding and using them. It was almost like ideas as a straitjacket, right? It's social norms. It's these are the ideas that you have and that the society that believes, and this will shape the way everybody acts. And there's actually not one school of constructivism. There's 20, there's 30, based on Marxism, feminism, or you name it, ism, that in the end of the day, it's collectivism. It just binds everybody, and we define them by thoughts outside of them, okay? And if you look at these three definitions, I'm sorry, these three schools of thought, you know, there's all these words in here like states, institutions. Yeah, there's preferences, but whose preferences are they, right? There's social norms, but they aren't ideas influencing action, they're constraining. And I kept asking myself, you know, what ideas do we really need to be talking about here? You know, what ideas held by whom is going to affect how things happen? And I turn to my military colleagues and I say, we need philosophy, right? Why do we need philosophy, Scott? What's that for? I deal with concrete, real-world problems that I have to solve. I've heard an answer to that before, right? We need philosophy to be able to deal with concrete, particular real-life problems. And she said it at West Point, right? Brilliant, okay? And I go and I show my military friends that everybody has a philosophy, and we use it to answer these basic questions, you know, right out of philosophy, who needs it? You know, and I show them that these are the five basic branches of philosophy, and it's real to them. And I just, maybe at OCON, maybe you don't need this level of detail, but I wanted to share that I give this to my military students as well. This slide, right? So, but the Chinese, what's their philosophy? They need philosophy too. Where did they get it? I don't think they get it from Miss Rand. They get it from these four guys. Well, maybe not that guy so much. Okay, so these, of course, are Confucius, Lao Tzu, founder of Taoism, and a Buddha. Okay, and you can tell me, oh, no, I saw the Great Cultural Revolution movie, and that's all gone. Well, it's not. It tried to kill it, but it failed. The average guy on the street in China, though his worldview is still driven by ideas passed down from these three. the intellectuals who are arguing over what international relations should be are citing ideas by these three. Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Communist Party, is using these ideas to convince his own people where to go, to convince the region that where they're going is good. My contention is these ideas still matter. But before I get into those specific ideas, I got to give you a bit of background on how these three work together, right? We got 2,000 years of Chinese intellectual history. So you guys got 4 or 5 minutes? Okay, well, let's go. So the Book of Changes, which is important in Confucianism and Taoism, says that there are many roads to the same destination, and it leads to a syncretic view of philosophy in China. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. I can't tell you how many times I was hiking up a sacred mountain in China, and there's the party cadre, and we'll stop at the Confucian temple, make a donation, pray. Stop at the Buddhist temple, stop at the Taoist temple, pray a little here, pray a little there. We got all bases covered. Okay? And I'll take a little bit of ideas from each one. So let's dive in to Chinese intellectual history. And it starts back in the Warring States period, where there were many different states fighting over control of people, resources, land, trying to be the top dog. And during this time, what we now think of as Chinese thought was developing. There were many schools vying for importance, guys like Confucius trying to sell his services to a king somewhere and say, hey, I can be your prime minister, I can be your general. My school of thought is the best. And by the end of the Warring States, Confucianism, symbolized by the character Ru on top, and Taoism, which you've probably seen before, kind of emerge as the main two. And then the Qin Dynasty is established. China becomes one. And Taoism becomes preeminent because he followed a school of thought called legalism, which is a branch of Taoism that basically the people just need to be told what to do. And it also has origins in divination and fortune telling. And he thought he was going to be immortal. He was looking for ways to do it. And that's why you get these terracotta warriors buried around his tomb. But he didn't last that long. And the Han Dynasty took over. And as Buddhism made its way over the Himalayas, Confucianism became the philosophy of state. The Han Emperor said, this is the way I'm going to run my empire. We set up an examination system to get the best people at Confucianism to run the country in our bureaucracy. These pictures, of course, are not from the Han Dynasty. They're from the Qing Dynasty. But the idea is there were these large test-taking centers where everybody had to go who wanted to be an official. They would study for years. Families would invest their fortunes in order to get a guy from their family in the bureaucracy and take the test. So Confucianism is now well established. A few centuries later, the Tang Dynasty is in charge, and the imperial family becomes smitten with Buddhism. Start giving it favors, start giving it money, the priests become important, and that's why you see a flourishing of Buddhist art across China. And it becomes more involved in the daily lives of people, but Confucianism is still used to run the empire. The important thing about Buddhism here is its idea of the all in the one really enabled Chinese syncretism and allowed them to start blending philosophies. A few centuries later in the Song Dynasty, the empire's in trouble. We got barbarians coming from the north, from the northwest. They have to move the capital down south, and among the intellectual class, there's a lot of worrying. What are we gonna do? What are the right ideas? And a flourishing period of discussion. And you actually have Confucian scholars attacking Taoist scholars in their texts and back and forth. The end result is Confucianism, and specifically Neo-Confucianism, becomes the reigning doctrine. And what Neo-Confucianism did is it developed some of these ideas, but it also incorporated Taoist metaphysics and the like. So the Confucianism that the West came in contact with later was settled here. A couple centuries later, the Republic of China is formed. The emperor is overthrown. And Dr. Sun Yat-sen heavily influences the ideology of the time. Now, he was educated in the United States. He spent some time in exile in Japan. He had brought a lot of different ideas in. His party, the Kuomintang, was actually a Leninist party with Soviet advisors. It was influenced by the West. It was influenced by the Soviets. It was influenced by traditional philosophy. And if you look at his three principles of the people, nationalism, democracy, and socialism, you see strains of all of those various schools of thought embedded in there. He didn't last very long. And on October 1st, 1949, as Mao said, the Chinese people stand up. And it was the Chinese people standing up because their communism was not quite the same as Soviet communism. In fact, Mao's eventual split with the Soviets was partly because he wanted a Chinese view of socialism that he thought was needed in order to implement there. He was actually a school teacher in a traditional Confucian school when he was just starting out. So Confucianism, Taoism did not completely go away. Of course, Cultural Revolution happened a few years later, and he tried to kill it, right? This is a picture of a Confucian temple being torn down. He really did try to stamp out the old, but he didn't. He just drove it underground. And this was driven less by, I don't want these ideas, than I want power. So 10 years later, they emerge, and that didn't work. Mao made a mistake. In fact, the official government line in the PRC is Mao was 70% right, 30% wrong. So there is freedom of thought. You have the ability to disagree 30%. It was 30% wrong. So we move on. Mao's dead. Deng Xiaoping takes over. And this doesn't happen immediately, but over the course of the last several decades, the traditional system has come back, influenced a bit by some of the ideas they got from the Soviets, a little bit from America, but also from your traditional schools of thought. And this is what they're using today to legitimize their regime and to understand how to operate in the international environment. So what are those ideas? Well, let's start with metaphysics. And there's a huge corpus of Chinese philosophy. I've tried to distill just the core ideas that really matter here that are used and influence thought. So we'll start with cosmology of the centrality of China. Of course, the Chinese name you've probably heard, Zhongguo, is the Middle Kingdom. It is metaphysically at the center of the universe. But Taoism and Confucianism ultimately hold this. Okay? The idea of the yin-yang, right, is this constant cycle. It's not just that change happens, but that change is nature. That there is a constant back and forth between weak and strong, between powerful and weak. And that this constant cycle implies that there's going to be change and that what's falling now may be rising later. There's a great Chinese character, shi, which means situational potential. It's one of those great words that's very hard to translate directly. And if you've read Sun Tzu, The Art of War, chapter 5 is actually titled this. You won't find it translated as situational potential, I'm willing to bet you. It's translated as energy, just as potential. There's a lot of hand-wringing over just how to translate this. But the idea, basically, is that in any given situation, there is a natural manner in which it's going to develop, if it's unhindered. And so you can't change things drastically. You need to change things subtly. The example given is pulling on corn to help it grow. And this is an old Chinese idiom, excuse me, and Mencius, a disciple of Confucius, actually cites it in his work. And so basically, the old man from Song comes in from the field, and he's exhausted, he's hurting. And his son's like, Dad, what's wrong? He's like, the corn is just not growing like it should. So I've been out there all day pulling it up to make it longer. And the son is distraught. Like, oh my God, Dad, what did you do? He rushes out, and of course, all the corn is dead. Because pulling the corn is not how it gets taller. Corn gets taller by giving it the right soil, water, sunlight, giving the conditions to naturally allow its potential to develop. And that idea remains important in Chinese strategic thought. This one's a little harder to get your head around. The power of the weak, the soft, and the non-being. And this quote from Lao Tzu on here suggests that in a bowl, the sides of that bowl have value because you kind of need them. But the bowl only has utility because of the emptiness inside. It's the vacuousness, the emptiness that actually provides utility. And interestingly enough, in preparing for this talk, I went through the journals of Ayn Rand and letters looking for references to Chinese or Eastern philosophy. And there's not many, a few in her conceptualizing bad guys in Atlas. But in The Fountainhead, Gordon Prescott makes a speech to the Council of American Builders that says this. I was listening as I was preparing for this, and I was shocked. He says, you got to get around it. Architects, people think we build buildings. We don't. We don't erect walls. What we're actually building is empty spaces. And I was blown away. That is like right out of Eastern philosophy that Gordon Prescott says this. But for the Chinese, it's because in this emptiness is where things that matter happen. And we'll see how this manifests itself here in a little bit. And finally, and this might not seem like a metaphysical concept, but Confucius speaks of it this way. The family is the foundation of human existence, right? As opposed to the individual being the primary unit of man's life and concern. The family is so central, it's part of existence, okay? But how do we know all this? Well, in Confucian tradition, it's from the ancestors. The Duke Zhou said it must be good, so it's good. We'll do that. Confucius says, I'll stick with the ancients. That leads to ancestor worship, right? But the Taoists come back and say, no, it's by not knowing it that I'm going to know it. Yeah. You ever tried to read the Tao Te Ching? It's a whole bunch of this shadow boxing back and forth, right? Which is why I liken this a lot to, not exactly, but you know, it's kind of the idea of Plato's shadows on the side of a cave. You really can't see anything. In fact, they go a step further and say, well, really, if you want to know the world, stay in your house and think about it. It's the only way you're really going to know it. So, in other words, in Chinese philosophic tradition, it's very rationalistic. It's just making up ideas in your head and deciding that that's how things work. Now, I came across this investigation into principles. I was studying Confucianism. I thought, here is where I'll finally get it. We're going to find out what principle is, because they never seem to mention, they mention the word all the time, but they never define it. Investigation into principle. They keep not saying anything. And finally, a Neo-Confucian scholar, Wang, he said, I'm going to figure this out. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to stare at a bunch of bamboo until I understand its principle. And he recounts that he stared at it for 7 days and he still didn't know anything. So, but if you read some of the passages, what it comes down to is a clicker, it's used to change the slide. The principle of a clicker is changing slides, right? It doesn't seem very useful, does it? But what it comes down to is that as a thing operates, they're going to take that as a fundamental, right? It's seeing the external manifestations, the small actions, as being fundamental, and it leads you to not look for the deeper meaning ultimately. And of course, enlightenment through self-cultivation, right? The Buddha attained enlightenment just by sitting under a tree. Confucian study by sitting around the sage and hearing him pronounce things. It's a very non-worldly means of knowledge acquisition. And finally, the power of a name. And interestingly, the Taoists and Confucians have different views on this. Taoists say, yeah, that those names are a little too constraining. Things are changing back and forth, so maybe that's not useful. But the Confucians, no. We have to have a rectification of names. We must put the right name with each thing, because if we say the right name, then we will act appropriately in that situation. So for example, you have to know Scott McDonald is Mai Dou Wei. If you don't get that, then you're just not going to know what's going on. I'm not going to know where I am. That was supposed to be funny. Okay, but the point is that for Confucians, actually the name you call things matters and it influences action. And we'll see how that manifests itself here in a second. But first we need to talk about ethics. So the Taoist, big about following nature. The characters there are wu-wei, or non-action. But it actually doesn't mean don't do anything. It means that you interfere in nature to the minimal extent possible. Think back to our concept of sure. Okay? Only where necessary, as things are changing, small amounts of guidance to get where we want to go. Confucians talk about relational ethics. In other words, what is right is dependent on my relationship to the person I'm dealing with. Fill your role in society, do the right thing, and maintain the relationships. And of course, you'll notice three of these all refer to the family, which is the foundation, right? Going back to metaphysics. But all of these are hierarchical and reciprocal, right? The guy on top owes something to the guy below owes something to the guy on top. It's obligations on how you act in this situation. So, but since we're the foundation of society, what can we derive from that? Well, first of all, if you look at a Chinese family tree, you have to know the right names of all these different people and behave to them correctly. I can't buy my second great aunt dinner, even though I want to, because she's bought it for me 8 times. That's a problem I have every time I deal with my Chinese relatives in Taiwan. It's mind-numbing trying to figure things out, okay? But then you expand that to the society at large. So we know that whatever's good for my family is morally right in a Confucian context, okay? That is the standard of value. If I have to lie, cheat, or steal to do something for my family, it's okay because it's for my family. That's the standard of value. So in opposition to the other family, as long as I do what's right for my family, that's right. But then what happens? You got that other village over there. How do I work that? Well, now that other family and I, we're my village. We're on the same side. Because whatever we do for my village in opposition to that other village is now morally right. Not just good, not just practical, it's morally justifiable. You got another township, we got my township. And it goes like this on up the chain with the emperor at top. Of course, you know, I said these relations are both ways, right? And so now you have the emperor on top, Confucian relationship of emperor to minister, it extends all the way down. So this is a banner on the streets in China, modern day, without the family. Well, when you have the country, only then do you have the family. So the hierarchy ultimately puts the leadership on top. So, and in politics, of course, sub-branch of ethics. So it starts with hierarchy. The Taoists say, well, in accordance with nature, you follow the Tao. That's how you rule people. Well, that's how the society should be governed. So how do I do that? Well, a good analogy of what they're thinking is cooking a small fish, right? So you put the fish over the fire, and you don't want to be flipping that sucker back and forth. The little fish is going to disintegrate. It's going to be no good anymore. You leave it on there just the right amount of time, nice little flip. You pull it off. The minimal amount required in order to influence the situation positively. And this melds with what the Confucians say. You fill your proper role. You treat others as they should be treated. If you're doing it right, you should not have to do too much. Several times in the Confucian text, you say, well, if the leader just sits there and acts morally, picks good ministers and gives them good instructions, he should not have to do anything. And of course, Confucianism adds a lot of rites and rituals, practices that you should be doing, which keeps you in line because you're doing the right thing. Just real quick on aesthetics, of course, Taoism, it has to reflect the nature, the relationship between nature and man. And if you can find man in that painting, there's a little guy in a storm-tossed boat in a little tiny village over there, right, in his proper place, which is dominant? Nature. And then Confucianism says, well, the arts are about building a harmonious society. So Confucius was big that a gentleman should be playing music, good music, so that it puts the spirit of the people in the proper mode, and they're happy, and they're doing the right thing. Okay, so there's some core ideas of Chinese philosophy. I know that's quick fire hose effect, but what we want to see now is how those ideas impact the way modern PRC decision makers, People's Republic of China, decision makers are acting. So we start with how does the Chinese leadership see the world? And I would argue in accordance with their underlying philosophy, the philosophy we just outlined. And that, of course, all starts with the centrality of China. It remains the central kingdom, 5,000 years of civilization. Everybody should respect us. We should lead this region, if not the world. But how does that work? To say I'm the center and I should be the leader doesn't tell me a whole lot, right? Well, hierarchy. We talked about hierarchy and the proper relations there. So what happens if you have the PRC and we have another country? Well, that's easy. We've seen this show before, right? My country there, you put the emperor up on top. Xi Jinping remains on top, okay? But that doesn't tell us exactly what he's supposed to do there. How is he supposed to rule? Well, fortunately, their foreign minister told us a few years ago at an Association of Southeast Asian Nations meeting, and everybody there understood quite clearly what he meant. China's a big country, we're in charge. Deal with it. Okay, well, one more little bit of philosophy I gotta throw in here. This is a better place to do it. On the proper role of a leader. This handsome young lad is Xunzi, not Sunzi, who wrote The Art of War, Xunzi, who was a Confucian, who said, you know what? There's three ways you can lead. The first way is using power, qiang. You just use power to try to get what you want. And that's kind of this idea. We got this clash going, right? And it leads to chaos. It's messy. We don't like that. Chaos is bad. Second method is hegemony. I have enough power, I can control things, not let people get out of line. And this is second best. Sometimes because you're using power, it leads to some chaos, but sometimes it can lead to peace and harmony. It depends on how it's done, but it's not as good. When the PRC leadership says America is a hegemonist and that's wrong, we want to stop it, this is what they're talking about. They, on the other hand, should lead through kingship, proper leadership, fulfilling their role, being a moral exemplar, and leading people to live harmoniously. And a little tongue-in-cheek, I chose my little dollar sign here. I actually, looking for clip art, I searched hegemony on the web, and I got this article by a rabid leftist on cultural hegemony. And a dollar sign came up, and I said, you know, I gotta take that. Because the idea here is I'm leading with virtue. And let's face it, we're at Ocon. So this young lady here is leading with virtue. But the idea is that just by doing well and leading with virtue, everyone's going to follow me and I won't have to use force. Just submit and everything will be fine. Okay, but we're not there yet. So how do we get there? And we know that nature is constantly changing, but I want to make sure it changes in my direction. So I got to leverage the nature of change and the situational potential of the situation, right? We're back to pulling corn, or more importantly, not pulling corn. Because if you want to affect situations, we've learned that you have to do small things early. An example given in Sun Tzu and the Art of War, generically, I'll make it specific. Say you want to change the course of the Yangtze River, the Changjiang. If you do that down by Shanghai, it's going to take a lot of effort, a big dam, lots of manpower, right? If you go up to Tibet, near the source of the river, you can change the whole course of that river with a couple stones and a log. So where in the international situation can I find small points to change the course of history to go the way I want to? What are the little levers I can pull? And an example is if you go to several places in Asia, you find these for sale all over the place. Lucky bamboo. It's actually not bamboo, it's part of the lily family, but that's not important, names are important. But you make this grow the way you want, not by twisting it, in which case it breaks, but by altering the manner in which it receives its nourishment so it grows in the way you want. And they make some really cool shapes out of this. Okay, but that just told you that I need to pull little levers. What are those little levers? So the Marine in me comes out and I give you the four components of national power. Okay. So these are the four ways that we say we can use our power to influence things. Diplomatic. Okay. Here's the climate change talks. The PRC does not care about climate change. I know. Surprising. It surprises the hell out of my military colleagues. Okay. But this was brilliant, right? Copenhagen conference. Obama puts all his capital in there, big deal, we're gonna solve climate change. China walks in and says, there's not gonna be a deal, we're going home, right? No deal, who's in charge here? Not the United States. A couple years later, the Paris conference, China comes in full court press. There will be a deal, we will ensure that it'll happen. There's a deal. And then at the G20 summit in Hangzhou is where the US and the PRC file the article saying, yes, we're going to do this. I forget the exact name. There's a name for it. So they're filing these. And look at the picture. In China, the U.S. is coming to file the climate change papers. Who's in charge here? Right? It was pretty clear. They've also tried to leverage other nations through the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the idea being other nations outside the U.S., through outside the U.S. system. Bring them together so that they're running things instead of the US, changing the nature of the international environment. Okay, in the informational realm, we want to change how they think about us and the world. Anybody know where this is? This picture over here with the red signs? Times Square, that's right. Huge advertising campaign. For many months, it was all red, all China. There was a coincident television commercial campaign on how wonderful China is at contributing to the world's history. Small things on how we change things. This newspaper here is China Watch. Looks like part of the Washington Post. It is a paid advertisement of the China Daily, the English language Communist Party mouthpiece, but it appears in the Washington Post. And if you look really, really small, it says right there, China Daily. It's in the paper, it's on the website, it's putting out their line in a way that it looks like it's the Washington Post. In fairness, their line probably is not that different from the Washington Post. But the point is that they want you to have their words, okay? To understand the environment, they're changing the way you think about the environment, the way you think about them. In the military, this is one of the islands they're reclaiming, the features they're turning into an island, to be more specific, all right? To encircle the territory. I'll talk more about that in a minute. And this other image here are range lines that we actually draw on some of their missile systems to show how we can't get into the area of the PRC. Changes the way we think about the military problem. Economics, they recently took out a forced Sri Lanka to give them a 99-year lease on this port, the Hambantota port in southern Sri Lanka. Basically gave them a loan that they knew they couldn't pay off, and then say, hey, you can't pay this off, give us the port. And there are reasons they want this port. It's part of their Belt and Road Initiative, where they're hoping to influence the way economics are done across the Asian continent, not just by establishing linkages, because let's face it, trade along these lines, it's a good thing, nothing wrong with that, but by controlling ports, doing things in Pakistan, Burma, other places like they did in Sri Lanka to actually own and limit access to others so that they can shape the environment and the way that things happen. Another way that they're shaping the environment, and this falls broadly in the information, is with the meaning of a word, right? We said the meaning of the word is important. So you may have heard of the three warfares concept. These are three broad categories of information warfare that the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, is supposedly using. So what they're trying to do, the public opinion area, is change what we think about the PRC. Like, who is economically dependent upon whom? If you watch the press, they'll tell you flat out, we are completely dependent on the PRC, right? Truth is not so much that. They suffer a lot more if trade stops. Trade, which by the way, is funded by many multinational corporations from Taiwan, Europe, United States, and elsewhere. We just buy the cheap stuff that can be produced elsewhere. But you've probably saw the Marriott hotels. Delta Airlines got in trouble with PRC for the way they were listing Taiwan on their website and the huge campaign that the PRC has undertaken to change this and stop Cold War thinking and representing Taiwan as a country. And psychological warfare, do our enemies think they can win? The range rings on a map. Our weapons are so great that nobody can handle them, right? They're trying to change how we think about it. And who has more resolve? Are you willing to trade LA for Taiwan? Legal warfare, what is the meaning of international rules, standards, words? Through public statements, through actions on the ground or on the water, they're trying to change what some international treaties actually mean, such as the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is the general agreement on how maritime territory and use is delimited. Okay, that weird one, that weak, soft, non-being, how do we leverage this in order to enact those other things? Well, there's a few ways. One, Deng Xiaoping's quote of hiding one's capabilities and biding one's time. You can make an argument that this is less the case now, that they're being a little more forthright, but still the idea of showing people that ultimately you're weak and that you couldn't possibly hurt anybody. The PRC still routinely talks about how weak they are economically and militarily on the world stage to try to convince people that they're not gaining in strength. Place yourself downstream. We want to be the ones that everybody comes to. Straight from Taoism, downriver is where the advantage is because people have to come to you. Make them come to you and you have the ability to tell people how things are going to happen. So once I get the situation going the way I want it, well, then I need to control territory. Okay, and this is where the full-on military guy is going to come out here in a minute. So we go back to molding clay, right, and having the emptiness matter. Okay, so let's play games. So anybody recognize this? No. Go, right, the Chinese name is Wei Qi. And you win this game by controlling territory. You start by building walls. Black gets to go first in Wei Qi. So there's the walls that black has built so far in this game. And there's the walls that white has built. But the walls don't matter that much because you win this game by owning that territory. Okay, I've said myself, Wei Qi is it's an okay analogy, right? But people say, well, it teaches strategy. What I'm worried about is what type of strategy does it teach? What does it tell us about the way they're looking at a problem? So let's look at a problem. So here's East Asia, East Southeast Asia generally, okay? And let's put some pieces on the board here. So there's my stones in the South China Sea. I'm gonna make them a little bit bigger by putting the range rings of some of the key weapon systems. And I'm gonna use that to build a wall, okay? But that's not that important. Inside that wall, I now have the room to exercise the actions to establish sovereignty. The PRC is regulating fishing. They are establishing fishermen safety zones. They are setting up municipalities and administering them. More importantly, they're escorting foreign military vessels. If you watch the press, you'll say, hey, this US ship was shadowed. This British ship was shadowed. The PRC is escorting a foreign military vessel through their territory. That's not the way we say it. That's a difference of interpretation. Well, I would argue it's a wholesale rewriting of current international law. That's what they're trying to do. But the walls can also be constraining. And you got this one along the first island chain here that we already have that disturbs them. And they're worried we're building this one. It's one of the reasons you hear them talk about containment a lot, even though we don't have a containment strategy. And I would argue we shouldn't. We don't have one, but they see it happening because in their conception, we're building a wall. So they're looking for ways to break out. There's many ways you can do that, not just military. You can use those other tools, those other components of national power, such as taking a port, building a new canal, and building a new room. That's my interpretation there. That's not actually happening as much right now. Some of those dots are actually there. So we got all that idea of how we're gonna do it, but why campaign against the United States? Well, one, it's the US's international rules-based order that they built and generally guide that is currently preventing us from having what we want. Their hegemony is in our way. We need to do this to push the US out of the Western Pacific, because that's our backyard. That's where we want all these nations to recognize the hierarchy, to recognize that we're the true king in this region. Those are where our rooms are that we want to keep the United States from influencing. Our vassals in the region don't want to pay attention because the US is there and the US is strong. We need to push them out, so our vassals must listen to us. And finally, the US has a lot of cool stuff we could use. Right? They're trying very hard to leverage our technology because they've been unable to move up the value chain in a lot of these industries. So from this, the philosophy, the way it's implemented, how they're going to campaign against the United States, I've drawn five strategic tenets that when I look at PRC actions, I use to help evaluate them so I can speak to US military leadership on what this might mean and what they're doing. The first is that they see the world as an environment of perpetual change, which means there is no win-win situation. They're trying to gain something, and it means you're a loss. What do they want? What are they trying to gain, and how it's going to affect us? Secondly, they see themselves as the rightful leader of the region. There is a hierarchy. They're going to act this way and expect others to act that way. They're going to pursue their interests through non-action. So yeah, what they're moving around with their military is important. Look at that. But look at the other things they're doing and how they're shaping the environment and shaping us. The rooms are more important than the walls. Look at what they get by where they're putting their forces and what they can do within those spaces. And finally, it's the importance of the words and that they use ours. The PRC is actively trying to change the nature of the debate so that their understanding of the world is used, not ours. And those are the five strategic tenets that I've been able to divine from ancient Chinese strategy that I think are still being used today in the PRC. And I use them to analyze PRC actions, and I hope they're helpful to you. And with that, I'm happy to take your questions.
Hello, thanks for your presentation. I lived in China for a few years. My wife is Chinese. I speak a little bit. So I saw a little bit of what Xi Jinping was doing from the inside. And it seemed to me that it seems to me that they may be acting a little too soon. Is that your assessment? And my other question is, what can the U.S. do to counteract what the China is doing, given that they don't currently really understand what's happening?
Right. Okay, good questions. Okay, the first question, are they acting too soon? Back around 2011, when they started really shaking things up in the South China Sea, I said to some of my friends, I said, they just blew it. They had a great thing going. They were moving along the right course of action. They understood the situation potential, and they were taking over the South China Sea without doing anything. And they've rocked the boat too soon. That was my analysis at the time. And then nothing happened. And they kept going, right? The West saw it. Oh, my God, a squirrel, right? And they went right back to it, and they started turning low tide features into islands. So have they moved too soon now? About a year ago, I was wondering the same thing. I don't know, to give you a fair answer. The West is a little more interested. The region is very scared. I think the U.S. government is currently working on something called the Free and Open Indo-Pacific. It's like a regional strategy under the national security strategy. And they've talked about the general principles and some of the themes of what they're going to do, but they have not released details yet. What details they release and how those are received in the region, I think will play a big part in telling us on how effective the West will be and whether or not they move too soon. As to the second part, what should we do to counter China? I think we shouldn't counter China because that's second-handed foreign policy. And that's a big problem with our foreign policy right now, in my opinion, or has been for the last couple of decades, is we have been looking at what other people do and we respond to that. And I say, okay, that's great. What U.S. interests are involved? No. You have to start with our interests, right? And what our government does in terms of protecting individual rights and ensuring that we are free. Design a strategy that does that. And then we worry about what other nations are doing, what that might affect it. Right now, a big problem with our policy vis-a-vis the PRC is that it's completely reactive, in my opinion, the past couple decades. And I've written on that last December in National Interest. So thank you.
All right. During the Warring States period, there was an allegedly egoist philosopher named, I don't know how to say his name, I don't speak Chinese, Yang Zhu. And according to that great source of truth and error, Wikipedia, according to Wikipedia, I'll read it, it's brief. Oh, come on. Use your finger here. According to Wikipedia, Yang Zhu thought, all beings have the survival instinct, but man, the highest of creatures, lacking the strength of animals, must rely on intelligence to survive rather than strength. And Yang Zhu felt that strength was despicable when used against others. That's from one commentator. Another commentator says, on the other hand, you could say, it describes his philosophy as a mixture of pessimism and fatalism. I don't find those things consistent, but right. Anyway... He was apparently very popular at that time, but he died. The popularity died out fairly quickly. So I'm curious what you know about it, and how can we avoid his fate as far as egoism is concerned? And one other quick question: there's this little peninsula hanging off the top of China called Korea,
right.
And I'm wondering what you think we should do about the northern part of that peninsula, which is an ally of China.
Okay, thanks. Yang Zhu, I know about as much as you know. I've come across him, but I haven't been able to find a whole lot to dig in deep. I need to go back and find the Chinese, which is often harder. The important thing for this discussion is he's not relevant anymore, right? So how do we avoid his fate, right? We stay relevant, right? We change the culture. We get our ideas out there. As for North Korea, I am a China specialist, I will tell you, first of all, I think calling them an ally of China is overwrought. China is the only ally they have, but they certainly have their own independent foreign policy. I think the PRC has been very happy with the situation on North Korea for a long time. I think the six-party talks were an excellent example of them using small levers to influence the situation. Six-party talks, the purpose of which was to, supposedly to denuclearize North Korea. The purpose of the six-party talks was to keep the United States focused on something other than the PRC, in my opinion. because it was just this talks that went on and on and on. We keep dragging it. So the PRC is scared right now because Kim Jong-un was off on his own. He was doing something that they couldn't control, and that's something they've been worrying about since the start. That's why you see so many meetings between Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping lately, is because they're trying to be relevant to a situation that got away from them. Because Kim Jong-un was going straight to South Korea, straight to the US, straight to everybody but them. So they're trying to get him back. So what do we do about Maria, right? thank you, musical fans. So about North Korea. So first of all, what's in US interest? What is our objective, right? Our objective has long been stop nuclear weapons from being developed on the Korean Peninsula. We missed that one, right? And now they have them. And getting rid of them is quite the challenge. People will talk about military solutions. That is a very difficult military problem. I think this could go several ways, right? My wife was asking me the other day, should we even be talking to them, right? We talked to lots of people. There's been a lot of discussion, even in objectivist circles. Is talking to them worthwhile? And I said, you know what? When our children have a fight at school, we tell them, or a conflict, disagreement, and they're all in Montessori, I say, we encourage them to talk first. Now, before, and you know, that we use the Peace Rose system, and I make sure I say what I think, and you say what you think, so at least we understand each other, and we avoid coming to blows if we can. So I think there's a context in which it's okay to have that talk. That context is important. You have to know what the US interests are, define them clearly before you go in, and you compromise on nothing. I don't know what happened in Singapore. I was not at the table. So I don't know how that conversation went. I think some conversation can be had, but you have to be ready to pull out at a heartbeat. So that may have just put me at odds with most of the room, but I think there's a place for a bit of that. But I personally think that the threat from North Korea to us right now is not as big as a lot of people think. Because why does a state like North Korea get nuclear weapons? So that we don't attack them, right? Not to use them, but so we don't attack them. The biggest threat of them having nuclear weapons is proliferation if they give it to somebody else. That is the threat in that regard. I think Kim Jong-un, like Xi Jinping, is more concerned that he's in power tomorrow than he is about what the United States does. What he's doing is about keeping himself in power. And as long as he stays up there by himself, he's not that big a deal to me. As a military person, right? He's not a threat to me. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what I got today.
Thanks for your talk. My question is very straightforward. I wonder if you could recommend some books, especially on the philosophy and the military history of China.
You got to start, the history of China in general and its philosophy are highly tied together, which hopefully my presentation gave you a sense of. To understand China, a good starting point is Kissinger's On China, right? Because he has a lot of anecdotal stuff in there, as well as some good history stuff that kind of ties together how they're thinking. The last couple chapters is garbage. After he says, the Chinese are doing this, hug them! Is that the last couple chapters. So you can skip the last couple chapters. The hardest thing about Chinese philosophy is finding a good translation. I don't necessarily agree with everything, but Sawyer has a pretty good one. Ralph Sawyer and The Art of War, which is about this thick. His is about this thick. And the introductory chapters lay a lot of context that will help you interpret what's there. And though I don't completely agree with his definition of sure, which obviously you saw I thought was important, he comes pretty close and he tells you very clearly why he went that way. That's of Sun Tzu, that's of Art of War. For Confucius, pick up, which translation? The easiest one to get is James Legge's, and you can get that online. And it's there with the text. For those of you who have some Chinese background, it's the Chinese and English text together. And you can gain a little more that way. I can give you the address later. It's like ctext.org or something like that.
And on the military history, you have like a one book.
Read the Art of War.
Art of War.
Okay. Yeah, the theory behind there is a lot more important than the military history. Okay. The military history, like through all the imperial period, is very, I mean, the Art of War is going to tell you the strategy that was being used. In modern history, the Civil War was a bit of a poorly thought out bloodbath. Since then, they haven't fought a lot of wars that are well documented in the West. They fought a very long and bloody war with Soviet Russia along the northern border. They invaded Vietnam and utterly failed in 78. So they got some lessons from that, but there's not a lot in the West on the actual military part of that. So I would read the theory because that's what they're studying now at the Chinese Military Academy, and it's what they're using to try to figure out how to do things, as well as looking at the U.S. Gulf War and some of the stuff we've done since.
Thank you.
Hello, for the Papa World Alito, you mentioned kingship and how it was about following the virtuous one.
Right.
That reminded me of Plato, but obviously they never would have the chance to read Plato at the time. So I wondered, how did that kind of phenomenon happen where on different sides of the world, they both had some kind of platonic ideal emerge?
Okay. So I think I understand your question. They both had kind of this platonic rationalism?
Yeah, the philosophy king for Plato and...
Right.
The virtuous one for...
Yeah. Now, I did say it's not exactly, right? Mm-hmm. There, like, I showed the shadows on the cave wall because as I was reading that, I'm thinking, oh my God, this guy's going Plato on me, right? But it's not exact. But why did that happen? I think if people choose to turn to mystical, right? However that mystical manifests... However they choose to define that mystical, where else are they going to get their epistemology and ethics besides making it up out of whole cloth, right? At the end of the day, when you're saying, no, there's something out there and I can't define it and that's what the world is, it kind of naturally lends itself to rationalism, right? That's why we call it primacy of consciousness, because basically they're saying, no, it's my mind that matters first. Did I answer your question?
Yep, thank you.
Hey, so Ayn Rand talks a lot about how dictatorships are unproductive because if you have...
The dictators aren't?
Dictatorships are unproductive.
Unproductive, yeah.
Force is opposite to production. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the USSR collapsed because it couldn't keep up with the United States.
Right.
So China has this strange system where they have the one-party rule, but they have some kind of free market, so they're very productive right now. But I've read many people who say this is not a stable situation. So,
right.
So what do you think are the long-term prospects for China? Will they...
Okay, well, there's a few things going on in the PRC, right? First of all, the party, which I say instead of the government, because the government doesn't matter. The party has allowed a wide degree of latitude on what people do economically, right? It's kind of a bargain. It's like, hey, you don't oppose us. We'll keep things stable. Turn to on economics. And so people are generally not messed with economically. Unless they happen to have a piece of land the local cadre wants and then you lose it. Or you happen to be setting up your food stall in a parking spot that some cadre wants, you lose it, right? So it's in many ways, the average Chinese businessman operates with more freedom than you and I do, but it's all subject to whim, right? Because it's not based on law or anything. It's like, okay, now you don't have that, okay? Second of all, in addition to the normal individual trying to do well for himself and his family, right? They've been massively helped by the West, right? The Chinese economic boom is paid for with Western capital, right? Based on Western intellectual property and then exported to the West where it's paid for again, right? The main thing that the PRC has provided is cheap labor. They've tried very hard to get beyond that and move up the value chain, and it just hasn't happened. So to answer your question succinctly, one, they've allowed a lot of economic freedom because they think it's important for their regime stability. Number two, it's been highly helped by other people. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, and you asked, so what's the future? Thank you. I forgot. So the future is actually currently, I think, a little bleak, partly because I said their one competitive advantage has been cheap labor, and cheap labor is going away. The labor costs are rising because people are making more money, they're demanding more. They started moving factories further and further inland where there were more and more peasants, but the transportation costs outweigh the cheaper labor despite massive investments in infrastructure. So they're not moving up the value chain and they're pricing themselves out of the market. In fact, what's happening is many international corporations are already starting to shift production to Southeast Asia and elsewhere. It's not an overnight thing, but it is something that they see as a problem. They do not have enough jobs for the number of people that are increasingly needing it, which is frankly part of the Belt and Road Initiative. We throw capital into an infrastructure project in Pakistan, and we throw a whole bunch of people at it too. It's jobs, we export the people, they're there, they need something to eat. We export people to make restaurants, right? And some of those people are never gonna come back. And that's a good thing, but they're worried. And frankly, I think that there's a, I'm not an economist, but I think there's a good chance that they have a significant economic retraction in the next couple of decades. So, okay.
Yeah. Thank you for the talk.
You can ask afterwards. So, go ahead.
And so you mentioned, you know, some of these philosophical groundings for their strategy. They focus on the emptiness instead of the walls, non-action instead of action. It seems like that would undercut their strategy, that misconceptualization would cause problems and errors. Is that true? And if so, what would a rational strategy look like? How should it be conceptualized and what follows from that?
A rational strategy for them or a rational strategy for?
Or just like rational strategic principles and the kind of games that you would play based on those.
Okay. In terms of the rooms, not walls, right? In and of itself, saying, hey, I am going to make sure that I have my weapon systems and other tools arranged so that somebody can't get into my space that I want, you know, tactically, there's nothing wrong with that, right? What I think a strategic downfall would be, it's not the fact that they see that that is how they should control the South China Sea. It's the fact that they are going to not recognize when the situation is turned on them. From their perspective here, right? Because they've convinced themselves that what they're doing is going to achieve their objectives and that they're not going to see when the situation has changed. So it's the in terms of that philosophy failing, to me, it's the blinders that they've put on in terms of the way the world actually works and how they acquire knowledge. And for right now, they are misjudging Southeast Asian nations and their willingness to go along because they don't understand that people are not buying into their philosophy and they're choosing something else. So the strategy is not going to work for that. Right now, they are misjudging Taiwan because they do not understand the way that Taiwan has developed and no longer plays their game. So their current actions to try to take away all their diplomatic allies. And hey, if we get all their diplomatic allies gone, then no one's gonna be their friend and they're naturally gonna come back to us. It's not gonna happen, right? Because Taiwan really doesn't have any sufficient diplomatic allies now. It has 18 tiny, tiny little states. It hasn't gone back to them. So, but because they believe that that's important and they're not basing that on reality, they're just basing it on the fact that they've decided that that's what's gonna happen. When they finally get all the allies to go away, and Taiwan doesn't come back to them, they're gonna, oh my God, what do I do now? And that's how things are gonna start falling apart. I think they think that way because of their philosophy, but the things that are gonna break that down are actually more fundamental than how you approach, let's face it, that's kind of the tactical end down there. So, did I answer your question?
Yeah, brings up about 10 more.
Okay, yeah, I'll be around in a week. You've been a great audience, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to ayinrand.org.